This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, our guest is the president and founder of Women in Aviation International. In the news, we talk about the departure of FAA Administrator Michael Huerta, his replacement for now, and we look back at some previous FAA administrators and what they are doing. Also in the news, we have the Air Force Tanker Program, fighter jet intelligence gathering in Syria, woes at New York's JFK International Airport, and remembering astronaut John Young. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 485 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody. And I think this is our first show of the new year, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We had a bits and pieces episode last week. Owing to the Christmas and New Year holiday. So, yeah, this is our first actual gathering of 2018. Here we go. This will be a big year for us because it will be our 10th anniversary and we'll also have our 500th episode. So, looks to be an exciting year. But also, I should mention, and with us is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian. He blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hey, happy new year, everyone. Looking forward to a milestone year. Too bad it's starting off really cold, but looking forward to a good 2018.
Absolutely. Now, Brian Coleman, our associate producer, he's off. He's at the CES show trying to find interesting things. Maybe he'll have some that he'll bring back to talk about next week. And Max Trescott, who hosts the Aviation News Talk podcast, is also off. He's at a three-day Cirrus training event. So we'll look for those two guys to come back next week. Well, let me introduce our guest for this episode. It's Dr. Peggy Chabrian. She's the president and founder of Women in Aviation International. They began in 1990. They were incorporated in 1994. And WAI represents more than 13,000 women and men from really all segments of the aviation industry, including general, corporate, commercial, military aviation. Peggy herself is a longtime aviation enthusiast and professional aviation educator. She's got her commercial instrument multi-engine pilot, flight instructor, flying for more than 30 years. And most recently, she added helicopter and seaplane ratings to her flight qualifications. Peggy's been active over the years in aviation education, including being academic dean and associate vice president of Parks College. She was dean of academic support for Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Prescott, Arizona campus, director of the Center of Excellence for the Aviation Space Education at Embry-Riddle's Daytona Beach, Florida campus, and also chair of the Aviation Department at Georgia State University in Atlanta, Georgia. Peggy was actually the second woman to ever hold the position of dean of an engineering school in the United States. She also serves on several boards. She's the past president and board member of the University Aviation Association, and she served on the board of the EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association, for 16 years. Currently, Peggy publishes the Aviation for Women magazine. She's an international speaker and an author. Peggy, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here this evening on this cold January day.
Yes. Now, Peggy, I'm not sure if you remember this or not, but we actually talked with you back in 2011 when we were at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center, for what was at the time the 7th annual Become a Pilot Family Day. That was the year that we did the live broadcast with Milford and Charlie from Flight Time Radio. And we called you from the event. You were up in Montreal at the conference up there. I think Rob, you and David were both there for that year.
Oh, I remember that. And we had lousy connections, I think, or something, didn't we?
Yeah, it was a bit of a challenge, I think.
Bit of a challenge. That's a nice way to put it.
But that was also kind of a remarkable event for us as well, because that was actually the first time that any of us had actually met. And Dan was there. Benet was there. We also met Micah. And if you'll remember, we also met his late mother, Harriet, that year in June 2011. So it was a big event. Talking with you, Peggy, was a real thrill. We have some other sort of memories from that event. So, but we're glad to have you back on. Finally, it's been a few years.
Thank you.
Looking forward to a great conversation. All right. Well, with that, let's jump right into some of the aviation news from the last week. Is everyone ready?
Yeah.
Ready.
Well, we'll start off. We have a couple of articles from, well, the first is from Aviation Pros concerning the departure of Michael Huerta. His FAA administrator position term has ended, and the White House has offered no nominee to replace Huerta, who has said in the past that he had...
I hate to interrupt, but they did, actually.
Did they today? Did they announce a nominee? I know we had
They announced it late in the day on Friday. Dan Elwell, Dan Elwell, who was the
acting administrator.
No, he's the acting administrator now. He was the deputy. There we go.
That's right.
He was the deputy administrator on Friday, and now he's the acting administrator. Boy, I'll tell you. See, you take a couple of weeks off, and the whole brain just goes right into the tank.
But I thought he was the acting administrator by default, because the White House hadn't nominated a replacement, or did they nominate him?
You're, the story that came out of the DOT from Secretary Chow was that she had, I'll get the exact wording here as we're sitting here, but that note came from the DOT. So my guess is that if it were only a matter of, the I's and T's falling into place, they wouldn't have needed to even announce it. But I think it was also that they were worried that the industry might think there was nobody. And, of course, after last week's discussion with the president about, who was responsible for the safest years we've ever had in aviation history, I think maybe they wanted to make sure that was all straight. But if you want to hang on 1/2 second, I will administer.
Well, while you're looking at that, I understand Elwell was appointed to the deputy administrator position back in June.
Correct.
He's a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy, former Air Force and airline pilot. And he'd actually worked at the FAA from 2006 to 2008. So he's back. And he also had a role. I think he led the Trump transition on transportation issues. That's what I know about Daniel Elwell's background.
That sounds pretty good to me. And he was indeed an American Airlines pilot, and he flew DC-10s and I think the MD-80 and 767. He was also VP for Safety and Security and Operations at Airlines for America, which is the A4A group that supports the airlines, and he was also with the Aerospace Industries Association from 2008 to 2013.
Yeah.
But you're right, he's only acting, and he would have to be nominated and then get through the approval process through the Senate, and that just, of course, has not happened yet.
Right, right. Well, I wonder where Michael Huerta will land. Any predictions on that?
Well, since he's not a pilot, he can land anywhere he wants, can't he?
I guess so.
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't think anybody's talked to him about that.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting to take a look at what past FAA administrators have done after leaving that office. And I poked around a little bit. Of course, immediately preceding Huerta was Randy Babbitt, who was FAA administrator from 2009 to 2011. And you may recall that his departure from that position was probably not what he had in mind, that he had had a drunk driving arrest in Fairfax, Virginia, which is west of D.C., and then resigned. And that's how Huerta came to take the
position. You're right. And what was really ironic about that is that Randy beat the charges, however he did it, later on. But, of course, that didn't get him his job back. And he's in this. Let's see. The last time I heard, he was working a labor relations role at Southwest Airlines. And I can't remember if he's still there or if he left that job.
I think that he left that job just a few months ago. I think he retired in August of a year and a few months. In August 2016, I think he retired from that Southwest Airlines position. So that's where
Lynn Osmus. I don't even remember that name.
Yeah, she was only acting administrator for less than 6 months. Before that, there was Robert Sturgill, who was also acting, but for a rather long period of time. That was from September 2007 to January 2009. Acting administrator that whole time. He was never confirmed by the Senate. And he's now senior vice president of Washington operations for Rockwell Collins.
Hmm. Yeah, he was a Navy pilot, as I seem to remember.
I see. Yeah.
I don't think I realized he was never confirmed.
Yeah, never. Not sure what the history is there. Didn't look at that. And then prior to that, of course, Marion Blakey. She was administrator from 2002 to September 2007. She was, for a period of time, chief executive of the Aerospace Industries Association. That was until 2015. And she's now president and chief executive officer of Rolls-Royce North America.
Cool. I wonder if she drives one.
Yeah. Before that, we had Jane Garvey, who was the first female administrator of the FAA. She was administrator from August 1997 to August 2002. And she, of course, was the administrator that addressed sexual harassment allegations. I think these were principally coming from the Orange County, California Air Traffic Control Facility. And she made it clear that the goal is zero tolerance and implemented some training and accountability measures for the staff and actively recruited more women. So especially these days with what we see going on in the area of harassment, sexual harassment, workplace harassment, things like that, it makes you think of what she did and makes you think of what's happening these days.
Well, and I think I have to go back and check the timing because it's close, but I think Jane Garvey was the administrator at the time when the FAA caved in and allowed the city of Chicago to close Meigs Field. And but I also, the last time I knew of Jane Garvey, she was working in some senior finance position for one of the big brand name groups. I don't remember anymore which one.
Yes, exactly. Meridiam North America. It's a Paris-based company, investor and asset management concern for public infrastructure projects.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you, I noticed that, you know, following Jane Garvey, you've got David Hinson, who I remember very well because David was the CEO of Midway Airlines at the time that we went bankrupt. And a lot of the pilots, long before we went bankrupt, when we went into Chapter 11, we all complained because we said, well, why did they leave David Hinson as the CEO? And, you know, if he got us into bankruptcy, why in the world would we believe he was going to be able to get us out? And, of course, it turned out he wasn't. So, but a year later, he had a pretty nice job as FAA administrator. So, but what's interesting, too, is look at the dates, unless there's a typo there, that David was FAA administrator until early in November of 96, and that Jane Garvey didn't come in until the next summer, August of 97. So I'm trying to remember. I guess we didn't have an administrator at that point, and that's a little strange, but I guess that's what happened.
Interesting catch, Rob. Yeah. Well, he now serves on the board of the National Air and Space Museum, as well as the AOPA board. He's 84 years old now, and reportedly he still flies his Beechcraft Duke.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. And, you know, wouldn't it be nice, I was thinking about what you mentioned about Jane Garvey, asset management and all that. How old do you have to be before you have assets that need managing? Will I know them when I see them?
They'll eventually come to you, Rob, I guess.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Well, we could keep going, but it's kind of interesting to look at what these folks did afterwards. Some retired. A lot of them are on the boards of different companies. Alan MacArthur, he was back in the 80s, 87 to 89. He's now chairman of Airbus North America Holdings. He was the founder, chairman, and CEO of Legend Airlines, that regional airline. And he's been on a lot of boards of directors, EADS North America, GKN Aerospace Transparency Systems, a number of others. So it's interesting to see where these folks land after the FAA. A few of them retire here and there, but most of them go on to serve other roles in the aviation industry. And I guess that's kind of what you'd expect.
Hence my question about asset management and when they show. Okay, I'll stop complaining. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Peggy, what's so you're a mover and shaker. What do you think is in the stars for you after WAI? Any plans?
I'm having a good time what I'm doing now. I haven't
You're just going to keep growing,
and I think so. Yeah, we keep coming up with new programs and new projects and keeps it interesting and motivating, I'll say.
You're like the Energizer Bunny of the organization, I guess, huh?
Yes.
All right. Well, hey, let's talk about a couple of military items. First, the tanker program. This is where we get David keyed up. Business Insider, the article is, the Air Force expects first delivery from its struggling tanker program this year, but major defects still aren't fixed. Now, this, of course, is the Boeing KC-46 Pegasus tanker. It's based on the 767. Essentially, and is designed to replace the old KC-135s, which are basically Boeing 707s. At least they share that heritage, and although they're now re-engined. But, David, like every aircraft program, it seems there have been delays. What are we looking at now? We see something about the tanker's boom causing some kind of problems.
It's not going to be able to pass gas right away. It's really the problem.
which is what it's designed to do, right?
You're trying to do it on a budget, and Boeing is... I wish I could say that it would be easy to convert a civilian airliner into a tanker, because the Israelis do it all the time. But we always have to do things more complicated. So it looks like they're going to deliver it, but there's still going to be lots of bugs to work out, and it's just par for the course. Boeing's comment is the Air Force keeps changing the specs, So they're trying to hit a moving target. The Air Force is denying that, but knowing the way the Air Force works, they're changing and hitting a moving target. It's kind of why Northrop Grumman sort of dropped out of the whole Navy drone program, because they just decided the Navy was playing games too much and they couldn't get a lock on costs, etc. So,
yeah, it's really hard to operate a commercial, you know, business serving a military customer when the target moves. I think there's something going on here with the boom can scrape the aircraft that are being serviced. And if you're talking about a stealth aircraft with low observable coatings, you really don't want scraping on those coatings. And also I see that when that happens, the boom gets contaminated by the stealth coating. And
then it can't pass gas.
And then it can't do that. And then there's something going on with the camera. I guess, David, the boom operator in the Pegasus sits at the front of the aircraft, right? Whereas they're in the back. If you're sitting in the front, obviously you've got to have a camera.
In somebody's great wisdom, they decided it would be best to do this electronically. So you have cameras, instead of being in the rear of the aircraft and flying the boom via visual, you are now flying the boom via cameras from the flight deck. There's a boom operator's desk with cameras so they can fly the boom, because you do fly the boom into the receptacle. Or in the case of the Pegasus, you also have two wingtip for drogues. But this technology is, because it's new technology, is not working as well as old school putting Mark I eyeballs onto the back of the airplane. So as usual, we've overcomplicated things, and it could have been better to just to build a boom operator in the back. Besides, at some point, all of us photographers are going to be really upset, because there's going to be no way to take really good air-to-air refueling pictures, because it's going to be via television.
Maybe we can mount a GoPro on the boom. Think that would work?
That would work. Well, that's pretty much what they've got right now, is they've got four cameras that are multiple angles that they can monitor, and that's how they do the operation.
All right. Well, according to the article, Boeing is obligated to deliver 18 of the new tankers this year, 2018, by October. So hopefully they'll be able to do that. Another military item, and this I found this kind of interesting. This is something that I never really considered. This is also from Business Insider. This is, Russia gained a treasure trove of intelligence on the U.S.'s best fighter jets in Syria. And what we have here is that both Russia and the U.S. have top-line fighters operating in Syria, but that gives both countries an opportunity to observe the other's aircraft and collect data that they wouldn't otherwise be able to. David, what do you think? Is this a significant thing?
Well, yeah, it's very significant. You always want your intelligence on the latest and greatest aircraft. And for a long time, between the Soviets and the United States, we had third parties. Much of the technology that went into, like, F-15s and F-16s were learned because of the combat of the Arabs and the Israelis as third-party clients. In this case, we're actually flying in the same airspace as the Russians over Syria, and we can gather intelligence on their aircraft, and they can gather intelligence on ours. And we're flying F-22s, which is the latest and greatest, so they're getting up close to seeing what the aircraft's capable of doing in a combat environment. So it's an intelligence field day for both organizations. You know, we're gathering, I'm sure, as much information about fullbacks and Su-34s and the Soviet air, the Russian aircraft, as much as they're gaining intelligence on the F-22, which is the state-of-the-art fighter that everybody wants to know about. So then we'll see what happens if the Russians start disseminating that information to their clients, et cetera, like North Korea or China. Hmm. So it's the nature of the beast. Sooner or later, you're going to operate in an environment where the aircraft is going to be shown up as either vulnerable or give away some of its techniques.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky. You can develop and put into operation advanced capabilities, but if you use those capabilities, you've shown them, and then you kind of can lose the advantage that you might have. I imagine that both sides may see some changes come about as a result of this information that everyone is collecting.
Yeah, and there's a reason why we minimize the, you know, when we fly a red flag with foreign nationals, like our allies, et cetera, we minimize the role of the F-35s and the F-22s, so we don't give away all of their secrets. But you don't want to go do that in a combat zone. So you have to open up. And in this case, the Russians are flying in the same airspace, so they're gonna learn.
Yeah. All right. Next, let's talk about JFK Airport. They can't catch a break, it seems, at least not over the course of the last week. This past Sunday, January 7th, a water pipe broke. This is a pipe that feeds the sprinkler system at JFK International Airport Terminal 4, and it flooded a number of areas, including a baggage claim area. They had to cut power. Part of the terminal had to be evacuated. Travelers were stranded without their luggage. Kind of an ugly situation, or an unfortunate situation, I guess maybe is a better way to say it, but it was kind of made ugly in light of the weather disruptions that had preceded it, starting with the snowstorm the previous Thursday. There we had a problem with the storm, ended up being worse than originally forecast, I think principally because of the blowing wind. And so the airport had to be shut down to allow for the clearing of that, but that got pushed out and pushed out. Flights had already departed based on the initial report of when the airport would reopen. We had diversions. Some flights from Europe had to turn around, return halfway across the Atlantic. It was just a real mess. You know, I don't know. I guess these things happen, but people are pretty upset about the disruptions at JFK that resulted. I think there'll be some inquiries and things. I don't know. Rob, what do you think? Is this just something that happened, or are people going to be looking at this more closely?
I unfortunately don't think it's going to be anything more than stuff happens sometimes. I mean, of course, now we don't know how the water system was maintained at JFK. Maybe there were glaring errors that jumped out at someone who ignored them, and it just all kind of came together. But I mean, you have to admit, the poor guys at JFK just had to keep saying, this is just not our week.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that's been pointed out here is that the six terminals at JFK are each operated independently. It's not one coordinated thing, which if I knew that, I'd forgotten it, but it seems kind of crazy. So when flights tried to get themselves to JFK after the snow issues were cleared up, there were too many of them, and there were not enough gates available, at least not at Terminal 4, which had been impacted by this water leak as well as the snow. And you can't just pick another gate at another terminal, so they had even more diversions as the planes tried to get back to JFK. So I don't know if this issue of independent terminal operation is something that, I don't know, that makes sense, or there's other reasons to run an airport this way. I don't know, but it just seems like an odd thing.
You mean running an airport in such a way that one side doesn't know what the other side is doing?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It does seem a little strange, although I'll bet you when they instituted that, someone said, "This is the greatest idea we've ever had."
Yeah. I mean, what was the idea? Competition? I don't get it. There's probably some history there. We should probably get in touch with our friends at NYC Aviation, and I'm sure that we could learn the reasons and the history for all that in short order, so maybe we'll follow up with them. One last item is I just wanted to mention that we lost another astronaut, John Young. He walked on the moon during Apollo 16. He commanded the first space shuttle mission. He was the only person to go into space as part of the Gemini, Apollo, and space shuttle programs. He was the first to fly into space six times, or maybe seven times if you count his liftoff from the moon during Apollo 16. So there's a video, sort of a memorial video. NASA remembers moonwalker shuttle commander John Young, and we'll put that in the show notes. You'll be able to see that at airplanegeeks.com/485. Again, we're speaking with Peggy Chabrian. Peggy, president and founder of Women in Aviation International. Peggy, we've certainly talked about the organization here on Airplane Geeks over the years, but kind of bring us up to date, if you will, a little on what the current agenda is for the organization. What are the big issues these days that keeps you awake at night, I guess?
All right, well, a couple things that we're focusing on. One of them we have been, I guess, since the beginning, but that is to encourage more women to go into aviation as a career field, or also encouraging women to learn to fly, to be active in aviation. And we've had, over the last few years, something has happened. I'll share a story here. I guess it was about 6 years ago, Rod Hightower, who was the president of EAA at the time, was coming to be one of our keynote speakers. And he called me, I guess, a month or two before the conference, and he said, "You know, I have four daughters, and I was wondering, would it be okay if I brought maybe one or two of them, the older ones, to the Women in Aviation Conference? Do you think there'd be some, you know, some benefit, would it, you know, for their ages and so forth?" And I said, "Oh, certainly, that would be wonderful." And I shared that at a staff meeting a few days later, and one of the staff said, "Hey, that sounds like bring your daughter to work day, bring your daughter to the conference." And we kind of joked about it a little bit, but out of that evolved that year something we called, you know, bring your daughter to the conference. Well, for the next year, we thought, well, it was nice to encourage our members to bring family members, daughters, granddaughters, nieces. Why don't we open this up? The conference moves around to different cities. He said, well, maybe we should invite some kids from the local schools, Girl Scouts. And we set up, it was a separate program. It's a one-day program on the last day, the Saturday of the conference. And there's some, you know, hands-on activities. There's a couple speakers for the kids that are youth-oriented, if you will. And then we also have for the middle school, high school kids, some of the college universities who exhibit at our show. We had a separate area so that the middle school, high school students could talk to the college university reps away from the bigger crowd. And then also a chance to hear about some careers. Well, out of that, and that it's been continuing to grow. The first year, I think we had about 40 or 50, and now we have probably 350 or 400 kids who show up for that particular event. But 3 years ago, we said, you know, it's nice that we do this once a year at our annual conference, and it's great for the kids in the city and the location where the conference is located. But we've got chapters all around the world. In fact, we have about 112 chapters right now. What if we were to do something in the fall, away from the conference dates, which is in the spring, and invite them to host a women in aviation event in their local area? So we came up with some suggested activities, some ways to do this, how to, you know, get the word out to youth in your area. And we just had our third annual Girls in Aviation Day in September 2017 with over 9,000 young people participating in 74 locations all around the world.
Wow.
So that's been one of our biggest, newest ventures.
Peggy, one thing I noted in looking at the WAI website, which of course is wai.org, is the really large, at least seems to me, large percentage of the membership that are students. It sort of suggests to me that, you know, you have like a lot of folks in the pipeline. I think that sounds great.
Well, thank you. And one of the amazing things, even us, we've done surveys of our membership every 1 to 2 years. And I know a lot of aviation associations, they're lamenting the fact that their membership is getting older. The average age of a member might be in their 50s or some even in their 60s. And, you know, how do they get more young adults even involved with their organizations? And what we find is we have, if you took our total membership, it's almost evenly divided within 1 or 2 percentage points, that like 20% of our members are in their 20s. Another 20% are in their 30s. 20% in their 40s, and then you get to 50s or 60s, it's kind of combined 20%. And we attribute part of that to, and I'll use this chapter network as one means, about half of our chapters are located on college university campuses that have aviation programs. And we're constantly trying to do things like this Girls in Aviation Day, you know, getting people involved at a younger age and with the idea that they'll stay with us as they move through their aviation careers.
Are we making progress? I mean, do you have any data that helps us or gives us some hope that we are, being effective and that we are seeing more women get into STEM areas or aviation in particular?
I would say yes. If you look at a lot of different areas, engineering, we're seeing more women getting involved in engineering. And even, and I hear a lot, people say, well, the number of women pilots is still at, you know, the 6.5-7%. Depending on which data you look at. But my comeback to that is, well, maybe in the overall category, but what's been truly amazing is the number of women who have gone on to get not just a private pilot certificate, maybe an instrument rating, but are now commercial or airline pilot rated. When the organization had its first conference back in 1990, less than 1% of the airline pilots were women. And now that number is around 5%. Now it's kind of a small percentage, but the raw numbers, you know, we're talking thousands of women now flying for the airlines. And I found it interesting, you were talking about some of the past FAA administrators. I remember when Linda Daschle came, she was the first woman to be the deputy administrator for the FAA. And then, of course, like you said, Jane Garvey, the first female FAA administrator, had people like Deborah Hirschman, first woman chair of the NTSB. So I think we see more women in leadership roles, and that in turn, with that visibility, if you will, I think will help encourage other women to say, hey, there are opportunities to grow into management and leadership, and also for younger women to say, hey, yeah, women are doing these jobs too, something to look at.
Hmm. Now, Women in Aviation International isn't just for women.
No, it's not.
Men can join as well. What's the role that men play in the organization?
Well, about 20% of the members are men. And I'd say the men who join Women in Aviation are there to support our mission, working with women to be in aviation and be successful. Some of them are there because their companies are supporting what we're doing. Maybe a family member is part of it. Or they're coming and they want to be around women who like airplanes, and that's okay too. I mean, there's a lot, somewhat facetious, but that's true too, I think. That we've always said, you know, this is aviation, and women and men are in aviation. And a lot of our members, including myself, have had a lot of great men who were mentors for us as we were getting started. And we've always been open and encouraged men to get involved with the organization. We have men who are students who universities who are chapter officers, or we invite people to, you know, men to come and speak at the conference. So it's always been very open, and I think that has been a key part of our success. You know, we've never been one to say, hey, you know, we're women in aviation and we think, you know, men are keeping us back. And it's not been like that at all. We're trying to get more women involved and support and help them to grow in their careers. But we're very open and encourage men to be part of what we're doing. And I think it's been a great formula.
Well, you know, if I can add something too in there, Max, I've been a Women in Aviation member for, I don't know how many years, and I love the magazine, and all that. And but the one thing that I've always thought every time I go to one of the conventions is that the Women in Aviation Convention is one of the best kept secrets from men that I've ever seen, because if the guys ever saw the amount of scholarship money that flows through the events for training, type ratings, all that kind of thing, they would spend the, I don't know, $45 or $50 or whatever it is a year to be a member in a heartbeat. But the reason they don't is that women are better networkers than guys are. They always have been.
Well, since you mentioned the scholarship programs, I'd like to share something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. As you said, we have a variety of scholarships. Many of them are flight training related, everything from sport pilot, private pilot, instrument rating, CFI, all the way up through and including the type ratings. But we also have scholarships for maintenance training, one or two for aviation management. We even had one for a while if you wanted to start an aviation business. But this year in March, coming up just a couple months, we are awarding 111 individual scholarships valued at over $600,000 this year. Hmm. And in 2016 at our annual conference, it was the 20th year we had given out scholarships. And know that back in 1996 when we started, we gave out two $500 scholarships. That was the start. But in 2016, after 20 years, we reached the $10 million value of the total scholarship program. Hmm. And that was an exciting night when we made that announcement.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Where does the scholarship money come from?
It comes from a variety of sources. We have some of them come from companies, particularly the type ratings for some of the airlines or aircraft manufacturers, Boeing, Airbus, and so forth, will donate some of the type scholarships. But we have individual members who contribute or who will establish a scholarship maybe after someone has passed away. We have people who've won scholarships, and now they're at a place in their career where they've initiated scholarships. Companies who are trying to see more women get involved, who they're providing scholarships AOPA, HAI, I'm still looking at the list, Sporties. There's so many companies that are just trying to help help young people get a scholarship so they can go on with their aviation career. And we have a couple people, we had some individuals came up to us and they said, you know, you give a lot of scholarships and we see a lot of young people getting scholarships and that's great, but we know there are people out there who might be in their 40s or their 50s who would always wanted to learn to fly. So we have two scholarships for people who are not younger people, I forget the term we use, but anyway, to get a scholarship. But like you said, it's for men, women, any age. If you're looking to get some additional flight training in particular, I highly advise any of your listeners, or if you know somebody who needs one, to check out our scholarship program.
Hmm. Now, we keep talking about the annual conferences. This year's conference is where, in Reno?
Reno, Nevada, March 22 through 24.
And what can you tell us about, what attendees might expect to see or hear at that conference?
Well, at the conference, we always have an exhibit hall. And this year, I think we're going to have about 200 exhibitors, all different companies, again, representing your typical product supplies and things to buy, but also companies that are there with their HR representatives looking to hire for all different kinds of careers at their organization. Speakers, we have, you talked about an astronaut a few minutes ago, Nicole Stott, who is a retired NASA astronaut, and she's also an artist, kind of an interesting combination.
Yeah.
A woman who was an Olympic runner, who was training to be in the Olympics, and was involved in an automobile accident. She was riding her bike, and she was run over by a truck, who, through aviation, through learning to fly, helped her to get back into training and everything, a motivational speaker. We had the airport manager from Reno coming to welcome the group, an F-14 Tomcat pilot, motivational speakers, Shasta Wise, who recently flew around the world in the Beach Bonanza. So our speakers, we try to represent this wide variety of interests from our members who are in all areas of aviation to come. So those are a few things. We have a lot of education sessions, seminars, workshops. We're doing something new this year, open to the public as well as our conference attendees, called Tapping into the Drone Market. It'll be in the evening, a couple-hour program to learn about drones, whether it's learning to fly drones, learning to maintain them, learning to or starting your own business, just a lot of things about drones, a new area for us.
Yes. Oh,
wow. And I was going to ask that question. She beat me to it.
Yes. David and I do a another podcast, the UAV Digest, where a few years ago, we found ourselves talking about drones so much on this show that we kind of spun off a separate podcast as a focus on that. So, yeah, maybe we should connect on that one as well.
I think you guys should come out to Reno and do a live podcast.
Yeah, we like doing things like that. So, yeah, we'll have to see what we can do there. Oh, tell us about the WAI Pioneer Hall of Fame.
The Hall of Fame is intended to recognize women who have made significant contributions to aviation historically, and or particularly ones who may have done something as the first woman to reach some level of achievement in aviation. This year, we have three inductees, Bonnie Taberzi Caputo. She was the first woman in the cockpit of a major airline back in the early 1970s. Kathleen Fox, who was an air traffic controller and later chaired the Transportation Safety Board of Canada. And our third inductee this year is Brigadier General Linda McTague, United States Air Force.
Oh, fascinating. So is there a ceremony or an event surrounding the Hall of Fame at the annual conference as well?
Yes, on the last day, on Saturday evening, we have the Pioneer Hall induction ceremony, and then our closing, usually it's been a banquet this year, we're doing a closing celebration dinner event. But yes, that happens during the conference.
Okay, good. Shifting gears a little bit, I've been noticing lately some legislative action that impacts women and aviation. And there's a couple of bills that are out there. One is the Promoting Women in the Aviation Workforce Act of 2017. And I guess there's both a Senate and a House version of this. What's the latest on those, Peggy?
That's correct. And those bills were just passed in mid-late December, with the idea being the Congress is saying that they would like to see the aviation industry explore all opportunities to encourage and support women to pursue a career in aviation, and primarily because there's still a small percentage who are involved. They're asking the FAA administrator, and so we're anxious to get that position filled, to facilitate, to create a Women in Aviation Advisory Board. And the purpose of that board is to review programs and things that are currently going on in terms of education, training, mentorship, outreach, and recruitment of women in the aviation industry, and then look at methods to increase that, or how can we do a better job even. And then the last part of that bill is to, the FAA is to submit a report to Congress looking at some trends that may be discouraging women from pursuing aviation careers, expanding existing scholarship opportunities, and then coordinating professional training and recruitment programs. We were very honored that in the bills themselves, our organization was cited, particularly the Girls in Aviation Day program, as being an example of a good program that's introducing young women to different career opportunities in the aviation industry. So that was nice. So both the bills are similar.
And then there's a bill in the House, H.R. 4254, the Women in Aerospace Education Act. I think that's the one that we've talked about a little bit.
I believe that's the one that was kind of geared for more towards aerospace with NASA involvement.
Yes, you're right.
I'm not as familiar with that one, but it sounds like along the same lines of, more women in aerospace engineering kinds of fields.
Now, if we get too deep into politics on this show, we always get in trouble.
Okay.
We always get in trouble. So trying to skirt potential trouble. Does WAI get involved in much advocacy in D.C., or is that kind of out of scope for the organization?
Women in Aviation is a 501c3 organization, so we don't do any direct lobbying efforts per se. But we do provide, and some of the things we're doing at the upcoming annual conference is providing some seminars and things to talk about some of the issues that are out there. And there are issues, and Alpha, I know, is dealing with some things too with maternity, pregnancy, breastfeeding issues, some of those kinds of things that are more workforce related. And we're trying to be the, if you will, an educational resource. Here are some things that are in place now. Here are some other companies are doing. Here are some resources, if your company's not doing those things that you might tap into or join. So we'll be doing some presentations, like I said, at the conference to help address some of those things. And sometimes we'll see things in the magazine occasionally. Again, just trying to be more of a resource, not a direct lobbying kind of organization.
Right. And how about you personally? Do you have much time to do some flying yourself these days, or are you pretty much full-time on the organization?
Well, I'm full-time on the organization, but I do have own an airplane. I have a Cessna 150, and my husband has a Piper Arrow. Sometimes he lets me fly his airplane, too.
Do you let him fly yours?
Doesn't go very fast. Yes, I do.
Okay.
But yeah, just try to stay current, do some local flying, but I do a lot of traveling with this position, whether it's speaking or going to different events, visiting our chapters, just so many things. But it doesn't make a lot of sense to try to do that so much with the Cessna 150 or even with the Arrow. So,
So you're flying commercial often.
Commercials, yes. Yeah, I bought the 150 about 8 years ago, thinking, well, maybe I'd go back and do a little flight instructing again. I enjoyed that when I did it, and I could maybe pick up one or two students, but no, that wasn't realistic. But
yeah, you have to make a commitment. I would think if you're gonna be serious about that. Well, fascinating. Rob mentioned, I think earlier, membership. Individual memberships are, what are they now in the U.S.? $45, I think?
$45. And if you do the our auto renewal option, it's $40.
Oh. And you know what else I noticed? Rob, you said you were a member?
Yes, sir. Have been for many years.
So yes. So did you know that there's a lifetime membership option?
Well, it's a good thing that you mentioned that, because I was going to ask Peggy if I were to take advantage of the lifetime membership of Women in Aviation, does that mean I will live forever in order to fulfill that?
We won't make that guarantee, but that's a possibility. No, I just kidding.
But darned.
But Rob, there is a senior discount.
Yes, there
is. Well, in fact, we were talking earlier. Remember, Peggy, you were trying to come up with the name of the scholarship for people that have a few years under their belt, and that always works. Senior is not necessarily a bad thing, and I think I said a couple of times that when Flying hired me and as senior editor, I asked them if it was because I was very experienced or because I was very old, and they said yes.
Well, and I finally remembered the name of one of those two scholarships. It's called Wings Over 35.
Ah, Wings Over 35.
Ooh, that's good.
That is good. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I would encourage folks to take a look at the website, the membership options. As we said, the individual membership is $45. There's also a student membership, which is less, and there are family membership options, as well as this lifetime or lifetime plus 60. Rob, you'd qualify for that.
Hey, thanks, Max.
Well, so do I, actually. So.
Well, one of the things we're looking at doing this year, this will be a new venture for us. We started a new publication called Aviation for Girls. And the first 2 years, it's just been an annual publication to coincide with Girls in Aviation Day. Mm. But we're actually looking at expanding that into a more frequent publication, maybe digital only, to do it for multiple times throughout the year. We have the print version that we'll still do annually. But if someone's got a young person in their family or someone they know that might be interested, that's something we're looking at doing this year as well.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, Peggy, tell our listeners where they can learn more about Women in Aviation International. Where do we find it online?
On our website, Women in Aviation, is WAI.org.
Great. Well, Peggy, we really want to thank you for coming on the show. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you very much for inviting me again. And we'll see you, all of you, in Reno in March.
Do you know where the conference is going to be next year?
Long Beach, California.
Are you going to come to the East Coast after that? I hope.
And then Orlando.
Oh, you cheapskate. Buy Orlando. An airline ticket.
You're in aviation.
Yeah, I'm supposed to fly.
It's Nevada, California, and then Florida.
Okay, very good. All right. Again, Peggy, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian, with the airplane of the week.
Thanks, Max. As everyone knows, I was out at the Willow Run facility, and the trip I made in early December was to look at two EC-121s, or a Willie Victor and a 121. Most people didn't realize that there's a very interesting military aspect of an aircraft that our senior host, Max, loves so much, and that's the Constellation. So I'm going to do a two-part version of the EC-121 Warning Star, or in the Navy, it was called the Willie Victor. The L-049, L-1649 Constellations are regarded as some of the most beautiful aircraft ever. Clarence Kelly Johnson designed the L-044 Excalibur as a 32-passenger, 4-engine outgrowth of the Lockheed Electra. The original proposal was for a twin-tailed, low-wing fuselage with tricycle landing gear. Eventually, it became a tri-tail. With the assistance of Howard Hughes, the Excalibur was scrapped for the L-049. The TWA L-49 aircraft were delivered to the United States Army Air Corps as C-69s. Thus, the U.S. military uses the use of the Connie. After the war, the L-049s evolved into the L-749. The military version of the L-749 became the C-121A Constellation. In 1949, the Navy wanted a shore-based radar picket aircraft. Using the C-121 airframe, the Navy added a fuselage radome from the Grumman AF Guardian and a sail radome added above the aircraft's centerline. The PO-1W was a success and two were created. They would see service with the Navy, then the U.S. Air Force, and retired flying with the FAA. Lockheed took the original C-69 prototype and made changes to create the first L-1049 Super Constellation. The L-1049 prototype became the prototype of the WV-2 Warning Star. The WV-2 had the sail antenna able to be retracted into the fuselage. This was eventually decided to be unnecessary. In 1952, the Navy ordered 142 WV-2s, and deliveries began in 1953. The Air Force began receiving their EC-121Ds from the Navy in 1953 also. The WV-2s eventually became C-121Ks. The initial mission of the Willie Victor was to fly BARCAP, or Barrier Combat Air Patrol. Patrols occurred up and down the Atlantic and Pacific coasts. These missions supported the DEW line, the Distant Early Warning. The crew consisted of 18, one-third of them officers, the remaining 12 enlisted personnel. These missions could last anywhere from 6 hours to 20. The WV-2s worked with destroyers. In the Atlantic, missions were flown from Newfoundland to the Azores and back. The Pacific would fly from Hawaii to Midway Island. The barrier missions ended in September of 1965, and the aircraft were placed in storage. The United States Air Force also saw the advantage of the Warning Star early on as an AEW&C, or Airborne Early Warning and Control, and complemented the Navy flying gaps in the coverage. These orbits were 300 miles off the coast of the continental United States. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, EC-121Ks were continuously based in Florida to continuously monitor Cuba. The EC-121s would play a significant role in the Vietnam conflict. The ADC, or the Air Defense Command, on behalf of the 7th Air Force, set up the Big Eye Task Force. Originally in Taiwan, four of the five aircrafts were based at Tan Son Nhut Air Base in Saigon, with a rotating fifth aircraft. Learning from their Cuban experience, the crews of the Big Eye would bounce signals off the water from the lower APS-95 search radar from the belly. This technique would detect aircraft up to 150 miles away. It was using this technique that the EC-121D 53555, or triple nickel, became the first aircraft to guide two F-4Cs to shooting down MiG-17s. Because of that, triple nickel was sent to the National Museum of the Air Force in 1972, and that was one of the EC-121s that I saw in December. The Big Eye mission moved from Udorn Air Base into Thailand and became College Eye. It was College Eye where airborne early warning became commonplace and the mission became more complex. The College Eye missions were very dangerous and very tense. The Warning Star would become overheated with the fuselage loaded with black boxes. The biggest loss of an EC-121 occurred on April 15, 1969, over the Sea of Japan. An EC-121M over international waters 90 miles off the coast of North Korea. The mission was called Beggar Shadow. The VQ-1 aircraft took off from Japan, was on a signals intelligence mission, gathering intelligence on Soviet and North Korean communications. The 121 was packed with 31 personnel, 8 officers and 23 enlisted. The mission was routine and had been completed several hundred times. The Warning Star was intercepted by 2 North Korean MiG-21s. Deep Sea 129 reported under attack and then was lost contact. The 31 souls would be the largest single loss of air crew for the United States during the Cold War. Next week, I'm going to talk further about some unusual missions flown by Willie Victor during the Cold War. So this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
I still think the lines of that airplane are just, I don't know, they're spectacular. It's just got compound curves. And
It's dolphin-shaped.
Yeah, beautiful. And, of course, you know, the tail, the triple tail. All right, well, we'll look forward to part 2 next week. Thanks, David. As I mentioned, Brian is off at CES, but he wanted us to mention one thing. Now, you might remember from episode 481, that was the episode that I wasn't there, the one that everybody liked so much, you guys talked about the Commemorative Air Force annual 12 Planes of Christmas fundraising campaign. And Brian passed along some results from that. And apparently it was hugely successful. They raised a little over $200,000, which exceeded their goal from 1,224 donations. And those go to support the aircraft that the Commemorative Air Force restores and maintains. David, as I recall, you were able to donate for specific aircraft as well as, I guess, a general donation.
You could make a general donation, or you could actually donate specifically, make sure your money was going to a specific restoration.
And they list the top 5 aircraft. I guess these are the ones that received the most donations. The PBY Catalina, the B-29 Super Fortress, a P-17 Stearman, an FG-1D Corsair, and the P-40 Warhawk. So it's... It's great that the Commemorative Air Force exists, but also that they continue to, maintain and preserve these aircraft for us and for generations into the future. So thanks, Brian, for passing that update along. All right, just a little bit of listener mail. Paul wrote us. He says, I've been a big fan of your podcast ever since I discovered it 4 or 5 years ago and listen religiously. He says, I'm a retired naval flight officer that has made the transition to the civilian side of aviation into airport management. Now, he wrote us for a couple of reasons. One is he said one of his friends, a retired F-18 pilot who now flies for Delta, has started a military aviation podcast about being a fighter pilot. He says, I highly recommend anyone interested in being a fighter pilot or military aviation or more generally interested should listen. His call sign is Jello. He says he's upfront about his entry-level podcasting technique, equipment, and technical skills. And that does come through in the episodes, but the content is solid. There are only a couple of episodes so far, but I think it shows some real promise. It says the basic format is a BOGSAT. Had you guys heard BOGSAT before? I'd never heard BOGSAT.
I have.
Have you? Bunch of guys sitting around talking.
Yeah.
In which he interviews one of his other active or retired fighter pilot friends. He said, I lived a life, so maybe I'm biased, but here's the link. So I listened to an episode, and you know what? It's pretty good. This is at fighterpilotpodcast.com. So check that out.
I agree.
Yeah. Hey, were you aware of that podcast before, David?
Yes, it showed up on our Slack listener team.
Did I miss it? Oh, dear.
You did, but that's okay. Isaac will forgive you at some point.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Isaac. Paul also wrote because he's interested in the role of airport managers when it comes to, he says, fostering the growth of aviation in the United States. He said, in my estimation, there's a gap between what is being done and what could be done by managers of GA airports to foster pilot growth and community engagement.
And, hallelujah.
Yeah, huh? This is, he mentions you specifically, Rob, as someone who's, you know, written in Jetwine about airports and their importance in the communities. This is an interesting topic.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that at least, well, I shouldn't generalize, but there are few GA airport managers that I've met that are really into it, that kind of see their role as, you know, additional to keeping the airport operating, as having a say in how the industry grows. And so I applaud Paul for bringing this to our attention. And if he has any airport managers that he would like us to talk to, we'd love to hear them, I bet.
This is, it strikes me as, I mean, this could be a way to tie together a lot of different things. I mean, including, you know, Peggy, the kinds of objectives you have when we look at expanding public awareness, when we look at expanding the interest in or interest of young people in aviation. You know, if that comes from a national organization, that's good. If it comes at the local level, as you said, from the chapters or from local airports, I mean, all of these things can kind of come together, it would seem.
Well, you know, it does. If the people are, what should I say, motivated. I mean, it's kind of like the change we've seen in the air traffic control system. I mean, 30, 40 years ago, a lot of the controllers were pilots, and they were very passionate about aviation, not just being a controller, but about making the whole thing work for everybody. And I don't mean work in the sense of keeping airplanes apart, but I'm saying fostering growth. Hmm. And airport managers, I think, are very much like that, but that these days, there are a lot of people that just seem to see it as a job, and their job description does not normally call for, you know, marketing the airport or creating community awareness or any of that. Their job is to, you know, repair the runway lights, keep the grass cut, plow the snow, keep the buildings in good shape, and then you go home. Hmm. And I don't mean that as a personal slight to them, but most airport managers just don't come with the kind of training or the background that would make them say, wow, this is a great opportunity that we've got to take advantage of. And so, you know, it's a tough move to get them to see that.
Hmm. Maybe that kind of awareness on the part of airport managers could come from, you know, their national organization or something, you know, something from that level. I don't know, but it's
you'd think so. In fact, it's funny that you say that because I spoke, this is years ago at some AAAE, which is the American Association of Airport Executives, at some of the conferences. And I'd say things like, well, guys, I don't mean to. And I meant guys generically, of course.
Yeah.
Guys, I don't mean to beat you up, but I mean, look at the training that you get in order to become a certified manager. The CM designation, the even AAAE doesn't require any marketing or PR communications experience or training or classes or anything. And so is it really, we can't really blame the airport managers too much when nobody kind of tells them that this is how it should be done.
Interesting. So, yeah, Paul raises some great stuff here. You got us thinking, Paul, and maybe we can collaborate on something here and try to put something together. It just seems like a worthwhile thing to get into in more detail. So,
wait, I missed it. Did he tell us what airport he's working at?
I don't think so.
Oh, he probably didn't want to. But maybe he could send us a private email and let us know if we could have him on the show.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, and let's get some of these
Paul,
issues.
Let's
out.
See you put your money where your mouth is, baby.
There you go. You know how to find us. Kevin wrote to us and said a huge theme in the airline industry this year has been communication, and I think the podcast has done a fair and good job of highlighting examples of good communication as well as a lack of or poor communication. He says, as someone who considers himself a glass half full person, I smiled while reading this story and the optimism it gave me for the industry we all love. And this is an article at ATW Online written by Karen Walker. This is to the PSA pilot who made my Christmas Eve. And this is this week's good airline story. We don't have Brian here, but Kevin, I guess, has maybe unintentionally stepped in. The short version is this is a PSA flight, a CRJ-200 flight on Christmas Eve morning. And they're taxiing out. The captain says there was a problem and that they were going to have to shut down, reboot, and see if the problem was fixed. They tried that. It didn't work. He comes back on the radio saying, we're going to have to go back to the terminal, call for a mechanic, and see if we can get this fixed. So the interesting part is what the pilot did next was that he came out. He told everyone, quote, I know you all want to get out of here. Remember, this is Christmas Eve morning. And I'm sorry for the delay, and I know it's frustrating. So I'm going to walk down the aisle, and if you want, you can yell at me. I won't take it personally. And that's what he did. He walked down the aisle and, you know, chatting with the passengers. And, of course, nobody yelled at him. He went back to the front of the aircraft. He asked the flight attendant to pour some cups of water and put them on trays. And then he personally delivered the water to every passenger. And again, more good wishes for a Merry Christmas and so on. Well, eventually maintenance came. The issue was fixed. They went out again to their destination, which happened to be Chattanooga, about 2 hours late. But it wasn't a plane full of angry passengers, all because of how this particular captain handled the situation. So it's a great story. Karen Walker has written this up really nicely and invites you to take a look at it in the show notes. It's worth reading the full story. So with that, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest, of course, was Dr. Peggy Shabrian. She's president and founder of Women in Aviation International. Find them at wai.org. They're also on Twitter, Facebook, and a lot of other places online. Twitter, they're Women in Aviation, at Women in Aviation. Be sure to visit airplanegeeks.com to find out how you can contact us, how to subscribe to the podcast. You can learn more about all of us, see the show notes, and even donate, if you like, a few dollars to help pay for this show. The show notes, which have links to everything we talk about, some other resources, are at airplanegeeks.com/485. Let's tell those of us who are here where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, they can find me at anything that has Jetwine in the name or Flying Magazine in the name, either in the magazine, and as I always say, not really, just kind of a facsimile of me, or online at flyingmag.com.
Great.
And thanks for listening.
Absolutely, yes. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
Well, if you want to reach me, the only way to reach me, since I'm not on social media, is Brian at airplanegeeks.com. Or you can find me tooling around in an SR-7, SR-22, and, of course, once a week on Aviation News Talk. And last but not least, I'm David Vanderhoof, and I'm not Brian, and I'm not Max Trescott. And you can find me on Twitter at David Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Facebook page. Thanks to Peter Johnson for getting that up and running again. And I guess with that, we'll hand it back to you, Max.
You're on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, right?
DM, yeah.
Yeah, you said David Vanderhoof.
Oh, well, it's only been 12 years. What the hell?
Okay. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, along with David, as he mentioned, at the UAVDigest.com each week. Also with Mary Kirby on PaxXPodcast.com. Our intro music is by Brother Love. You can find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by our friend Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up, and thanks for listening. Rob on or no?
Well, I don't know. Here he comes, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. You were going to say something smart, Alecky.
No, I wasn't. I kept showing up as on, but I wasn't hearing you.
I had a. I was carrying my food over to the system here, and I dropped the salad on the floor, and then dropped my cell phone into the salad. So. I said, oh, shit. And then the phone started. And then you guys start ringing. I got, oh, yeah, there you go. Great timing.
Yeah.
So, figures. Anyway.
And the dog didn't get to the dinner?
I can't believe he's still in the other room. I can't believe he's laying in there. He's probably too exhausted. You know, it's when you've got to sleep as much as he does, it's pretty grueling.
If you have a photo that you could send that we could use for the show notes.
Sure.
How about a picture of Rob, Mark, David Vanderhoof and her right. In 2011.
Do you have one of those?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Oh, really?
Do you?
From Oshkosh.
Wow.
Oh.
Well,
remember when we gave the check over?
Yes,
oh, that's
I do.
Right.
I do.
We were at the breakfast.
Yes. I do remember that.
Wow. I was just a kid then.
No. Do you remember? Was it 2011 you said?
Yeah.
I can find that picture too.
Ooh, cool.
I bet.
Oh, in other news, SpaceX is going to have a very large insurance claim.
Why?
Oh, did the blast off not go well?
The satellite didn't go to orbit. They lost the Pentagon lost contact with it.
Oh no.
Northrop Grumman top secret satellite, spy satellite they lost.
Oh, no, because I saw the video from the launch and the land. I still can't believe you can send a multi-stage rocket up. The first stage, you know, disengages, comes back down and lands right dead center on the target, right in the bullseye.
Only a couple of hundred feet away from where it took off.
Yeah, that just blows my mind.
But evidently the it didn't get to orbit, so there's a large chunk of money went down the drain.
Wow. Hey, did you also see that some guy thinks that he knows who D.B. Cooper is?
No.
That happens like once every other year.
I know. Well, there's this guy I guess he's done a documentary in the past and is working on one now, but they put together a team of like a large team of investigators, and they think they know who this guy is, who's being a little bit cagey about it. It's actually a guy that the FBI had looked at years ago, but what they did is they took the letter that D.B. Cooper sent to the newspapers, and it contained some strange numbers, like a code at the bottom of it. And they figured out that somehow this code represents like information about this particular guy, Robert Rackstraw, when he was in the military, you know, it's his unit or something like that. But they're not saying a lot because they're still working on the documentary, and maybe this is sort of pre-hype for that. I don't know, but it sounds like they think they've found D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
We'll see.
I mean, think about that. I mean, that was, what was that, maybe 35 years ago?
This is like, what, 71?
Would there be a statute of limitations on that? I wonder.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, it's almost...
No, because it's a... It would be a... no,
federal crime?
It would be a federal crime because the amount of money he got away with.
Oh, yeah. This guy, Rackstraw, he was a U.S. Army paratrooper.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. A decorated Vietnam War veteran. He's now 74 years old, lives in the San Diego area.
Hmm. Wonder what kind of house he lives in.
Yeah. What kind of a car he drives.
Well.
What was it, about $200,000? What was the...
Yeah.
Which today was, you know, it's probably a million, right? I don't know.
Yeah, if he invested wisely.
Well, we'll see.
Well, some of that money was recovered, right? Didn't they find some of that money somewhere? I don't know. A
couple of dollars, that's about it.
Yeah.
Don't remember.
Yeah. So that
guys, I got to run. Been nice chatting. We'll chat with you guys next week.
Robert, thank you for your card. That was very nice.
You're most welcome.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I'm the guy on the right in the picture.
it's a great picture.
As a friend of mine down in Texas, I've got a Gulfstream pilot friend of mine down in Texas who called me and said, I love the card. I mean, the two babes are definitely way out of your league, and you ought to just put a big X on the guy on the right. And I said, okay, Bob, thank you for that comment. You don't have anything better to do with your time than call me and tell me that?
You?
He said, not really.
You should be flattered, though.
Yeah, that's true. And as he said the first time he got one of those, he said, it's very clear the both of us have married above our category.